Good evening. Welcome to Adam's Talk. We've got some technical difficulties. Apparently, removing the sound clip from our intro kind of changes the dynamics. Anyway, this is Ethics Talk. I'm Mike Leichstedt. I'm joined on tonight's show by Nicholas Brousseau. Would you like to say hi, Nick?
Yes, hello.
He's our senior anchor. I'm joined by Hope May.
Hello.
And I'm joined by Sarah Filippelli. Anyway,
I thought it was Sarah Elizabeth, but anyway.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Sarah, okay.
This is the comic relief portion of the show.
The topic of tonight's show is the civil and humanitarian strife going on in Darfur, despite our light mood. It's been sort of a topic of conversation in our group on Ethics Talk for some time, mostly about the lack of knowledge we all have on the matter. I guess we've all known that there's sort of terrible things happening in Darfur. But exactly what they are, I mean, they're not really covered in the popular media, or at least not United States media that much. And none of us really had much more than an inkling of what was going on. So given our recent interest in international law and these sorts of things, we decided we were all going to watch the documentary Darfur Now, sort of brush up on our Darfur knowledge, and then kind of try to hash the issues out over the air for our listeners. So that being said, I guess I'd just like to start the discussion with asking, what did you guys take away from Darfur Now? If you want to start, Nick, I mean, what stuck out to you about the documentary?
And I think we all kind of shared this sentiment about the film, that the one thing that apparently my sound is not working. Hello? Sound back on? Okay.
Just move your microphone down to your mouth.
All right. Sorry, amateur hour here. But in any case, we all kind of shared this sentiment about when we watched the film was that it didn't really give a good explanation or a motivation for why the Sudanese government was engaging in the atrocities that were going on. It was just basically explaining these five different people who were trying to combat the injustice that was going on there. In any case, what I took from the film was, because I was looking for that question to be answered, was one UN Security Council member whose name I do not have in front of me, and I couldn't tell you where he's actually from either. But he stated that the biggest issue that was going on there wasn't an ethnic difference, it wasn't this racial thing that was really at the cause of this injustice. Rather, it was a fight over resources. And so as I did a little more research, I've kind of been looking at it through the scope of that claim that it's a fight over resources. And I'm not sure how true that is still, but at least that was the one thing that I particularly have taken from the film and have carried with me further into research.
Fantastic. Sarah, was there anything in particular that stuck out to you?
I think the biggest thing that stuck out for me, and it might sound horrible, but was the... what I'm looking for. I wrote it down. The romanticized view of the white people. The rebels would always mention, the white people will come and help us.
Our troubles will be over.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I say romanticized view because I just don't
see it happening.
It's not that I don't see it happening. It's like, you know, these white people will come and everything will be better, and, you know, they said things like they'll put in electricity and they'll do this and they'll do that, and it's like there's no real, I don't know if that's going to happen.
Right.
You know?
I do. I share that sentiment as well. To me, interestingly enough, I don't know what this says about me, but what I found most compelling about the movie was not just the genocide, but the efforts of Adam Sterling in particular, you advised me was his name, sort of like waiting tables and taking money out of his bank account to print flyers and pass them out. I just thought that was somewhere between nuts and really, really, really cool, like to be so committed to something so distant, you know, like affecting his personal life. It was really just the morality of it all. There was no one knocking on his door, no one keeping tabs on. He actually made a statement. I thought this was really cool. He said at one point during the film, "This whole time I was kind of like waiting for the experts to show up. Like I was just doing my part, passing out flyers, thinking that the more attention I brought to this, eventually a Sudanese expert or a genocide expert or a Darfur expert would come along and take up arms, and now people are looking at me like I'm him." You know, it's just weird how that works. But Would you like a shot at what
sure.
you got out of it?
I mean, just I also was very impressed with Adam Sterling, and one thing that stuck out for me was how he said in the beginning of his college career, he was like the guy who was, you know, not political at all, and he would walk down the streets and he would avoid people who were doing activist work and handing out flyers, and he was not that guy at all. And then he took a class, and that sort of awakened his political nature, if you will. And so the whole transformational aspect of education stuck out to me. Another thing that stuck out to me was the movie also featured Don Cheadle and George Clooney and their work in bringing the Darfur issue to public awareness. And that bothered me a little bit because also recently Mia Farrow and Naomi Campbell were in the news because they were testifying at the special court for Sierra Leone in the trial of Charles Taylor about blood diamonds and so forth. And Naomi Campbell, famous supermodel, Mia Farrow, Woody Allen's ex-wife, actress. And you know, this idea that sadly we only, the media seems to only pay attention when you have like Mia Farrow, Naomi Campbell, George Clooney, Don Cheadle. What would it be if Adam Sterling was like the only guy working on it without the help of celebrities? That said, I think it's cool that celebrities do use their notoriety to bring awareness, but it bothers me that that is when the media seems to shine a light on these issues.
That being said, Nick kind of let the cat out of the bag earlier. We all have this sort of sentiment that we shared almost coincidentally after watching the show, that we still didn't understand the cause of the terrible things that are happening there. I mean, I think the documentary did an especially good job of, like, touring different points of view of the parties involved, sort of showing humanitarian efforts that are going on, showing different aids to help in Darfur and the terrible things that are happening. But we all felt like there was really a lack of explanation as to how this all started. Why was a genocide being committed? Although, you know, the term genocide is in contention, and we plan on discussing that as well. But how did this start? What was the powder keg? I don't think the film really covered that all that much. I mean, we got this sentiment that it was a disagreement over resources. What does that mean? I mean, are we talking about oil here? I think we were kind of led to believe that. But what use does the common poor have over oil? I mean, I just don't understand. Mm-hmm. Anyone like to take a crack at that, having done some research? It appears, I think, after researching it, that the reason it's not explained is that it's extremely complicated.
Yeah, it's really complicated, and I'm just going to read, you know, a sentence or two from this book, Building the International Criminal Court by Benjamin Schiff. It's an excellent book. So, sentence one, long-standing feuds. I'm pausing for dramatic effect, okay? So this has been going on for a long time, this conflict. Long-standing feuds in the Western Sudan region over resources, doesn't say what kind just yet, political representation and economic development boiled into military confrontations in late 2002 and 2003. And I'm going to move over to another sentence. Here's sentence two. And then I'll fill in the gap after I read the sentence. The government paid Arab tribal leaders, this is the Sudanese government, with grants and gifts based on how many soldiers they provided. Africans who volunteered were apparently turned away as the government selectively enlisted tribes it would remain loyal, including people from neighboring Chad, Libya, and other states. And these recruits became the forces identified by locals and outsiders as the Janjaweed. So what struck me about this sentence is that, okay, the Sudanese government puts out a call for militia, and it turns away Africans. Why? Because it felt they would not be as loyal as the Arab Sudanese. In terms of, you know, why, we could go back many years, but one of the key events that fomented the mobilization of the Sudanese government and enlisting the Janjaweed was an attack on an airport and various other governmental installations. And for these reasons, like resources, economic development, whatever, these ethnic tribes, three of them in particular, the Fur, the Mazalit, and the Zagawa tribes, felt, you know, I'm just going to be blunt, dissed by the Sudanese government. And they felt compelled to form an insurgency. The Sudanese Liberation Army and the Justice and Equality Movement, they formed these two groups, rebel groups. These groups were responsible for attacking governmental installations, and pursuant to those attacks, the Sudanese government hired the Janjaweed and also employed other means to quelch this insurgent movement. And as we were talking before the show, you know, if you want an analogy, it's like if you have a gang comprised maybe mainly of Latinos who feel dissed by the government, who then decide to take up arms against the government and attack government installations and the government hiring, like, Blackwater or something like this, a private militia, to attack the Latino gangs. However, what's alleged here is that these Janjaweed are not just attacking the gangs, they're attacking civilians, non-combatants, and doing lots of other stuff. So it's as if, the, like, if, going back to the gang analogy, it's as if the United States government was just hired these people who were then attacking parts of towns where the primarily the Latino population lives, because that's the strategy of getting at this insurgent movement.
Right. So implicit in this whole explanation is sort of like a power struggle. The government. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this or not. I don't feel particularly swayed by that explanation. It seems as though there must be more. That there must have been something else that happened. But, you know, even given that, there's this power struggle behind the scenes. A certain group doesn't have the favor of the government, so they start sort of fighting back for whatever reason. And unfortunately, civilians get caught in the crossfire, right? The government starts attacking villages where these rebels are known to come from. They start displacing these sorts of people. But then I have this other question. I mean, if it really is just this political struggle and it's really about a rebel movement, why is the Sudanese government denying humanitarian aid to displaced Fuers and the other tribes? I mean, it's not as though just occasionally a civilian gets hit by gunfire. I mean, villages are literally being ransacked. And then when the people run from the Janjaweed, when they run from supposed Sudanese army, they're still sort of kicked around by the Sudanese government. I mean, the UN's coming in with trucks full of food and stuff, and the trucks are being shot and burned and everything else to prevent these civilians from obtaining humanitarian aid. So how does that work? I mean, another layer of complexity.
I think there was a part of the movie, actually, where Ocampo is just kind of like, they're looking at pictures of, you know, the Janjaweed and, like, the villages that they ransacked. And it's usually near where the rebel armies are sort of situated,
mm-hmm.
and he makes the, I think the quote goes, if you, like, they're like fish in a barrel, you poison the water in the barrel, and then the fish will die.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, getting rid of their peripheries, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and then eventually weeding them out, I guess. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to what end, I guess,
mm-hmm.
would be the question.
Right, yeah, I think the, you know, I don't know, here's a little excerpt from an article that's on the show resources page. It says, further, the government of Sudan has paid no international cost for widely looting the assets of humanitarian groups as they were initially expelled. In fact, members of the government and militia leaders regularly flaunt this fact by driving through Darfur in their expensive repainted aid vehicles. So you definitely have this this sense that is, well, it's more of that's going on than just getting rid of the rebels that are in there. If you're going after humanitarian efforts, that is a blatant, like, we're going after people in general. At
yeah.
least in my view, that's what I see going on.
I have that sentiment as well. I mean, it seems like genocide. It really does. I mean, my sentiment is that people are being killed for no other reason than sort of association. Like, you're with them, so you're toast. But as long as we're on the topic, let's discuss this term in general. I mean, this term is thrown around a lot in the movie, this genocide happening in Darfur. I mean, they put it on flyers. George Clooney talks about it. President Bush talks about it. And the ambassador of the Sudanese government denies it. So, I mean, what do we have to say about it? Would you like to sort of kick off with our legal understanding of genocide, Hope?
No, I wouldn't. But I would like to just go back before we get to genocide, and maybe we can play one of our clips, which actually raises the question of whether this is a genocide. But going back to just fleshing out the why, this is just another document from the Center for International Development and Conflict Management from the University of Maryland. And it says that these this insurgent groups, the Sudanese Liberation Army and the Justice and Equality Movement, okay, they've demanded autonomy and self-determination for Darfur, as well as 80% of the oil profits the government receives from drilling in Darfur. So it seems like the government is taking the resources and not giving this region its due.
Absolutely.
They also want greater economic, political, and civil rights for the black Muslims in Darfur. The rebels managed to seize the towns of Gulu and Tina from government forces in early 2003, but the towns were eventually recaptured by Sudanese government forces. So I just wanted to, you know, throw, there's also this oil, there is this oil piece in there. But going back to the genocide, what is it? This is actually a clip from Darfur Now. It's about 2 minutes long. And just to set up the clip, we have George Clooney, who begins talking. If you recognize his voice, it is George Clooney. And then Don Cheadle, who does actually mention this attack on the humanitarian effort. And then the movie, after that claim is made, they're giving a press conference. The Sudanese ambassador for the UN then says, this is not a genocide. Everybody classifies it as a genocide, but it's not. So here's that clip, and it's about 2 minutes long.
China does a large amount of trade with Sudan, mostly in oil, and has a great amount of economic influence in the region. Egypt, of course, has a long history with the Sudan. Both countries believe they have a role to play in this process and must do more to get all the parties on the table in time. It's just not enough.
There has been a deafening silence. Very recently, there were aid workers that were attacked. A convoy was overcome and supplies burned that were strictly for humanitarian aid. We need to press that these stories not be small paragraphs on page 17. We need these stories out.
Our call today is that priorities be linked to human survival, not political profit. Because someday this will end. And the question then will be asked, where did the nation of these United Nations stand?
The situation in Darfur is very much over-dramatized. The United States is the only country in the world that has labeled what's going on in Darfur as a genocide. Our view is that the United States uses this for its own public use, domestic use, especially during previous election campaigns to win the black voters or other lobbies in the United States. Any war is catastrophic. There is no merciful war, but it is not a genocide.
So just to sort of rehash in this clip, you couldn't make it out at the end there, that was Abdal Mahmoud Abdal Halim Mohammed stating that this is not a genocide, that in fact it's a civil war. And of course, you know, he admits war is costly and war is bad. But it's the media and its political opponents who are classifying what is happening in Darfur as a genocide. So we kind of want to discuss this. What's going on? I mean, is it genocide, isn't it? If you have anything to say, I'd like to mention this is a talk show. Feel free to call in. This is Ethics Talk. The number to call in is 646-727-3. 3928. So if you have something to add to the conversation, by all means. So I guess to kick it off, what do you guys think? I mean, Nick, Sarah, what comes to mind when you hear the word genocide?
I said earlier that the first thing that pops into my head is the Holocaust,
right?
Because that was the systematic killing of millions of Jewish people, purely for the fact that they were Jewish. And it's genocide to a T, really. And when you apply it to the situation in Darfur, the shoe fits, basically, you know?
I mean, when I hear genocide, I definitely think of a particular extermination of a particular group. So there's some group that's being exterminated based on either race, ethnicity, you know, belief system, religious attitudes, whatever. So I guess that's my definition of it. And I just like to say it seems, in that definition, for me, genocide is less clear in the situation in Darfur. It just seems less clear because it's obvious in the case of Nazi Germany, you know, with the extermination of Jewish people. I think that's definitely a clear-cut case. In Darfur, what group's really being, you know, taken out? I guess it would be the African Muslims in that area would be the group that we would be thinking would be...
The Fur, the Mazalit, and the Zaghawa ethnic groups.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the three tribes that really populate the Darfur area?
Those are the three tribes that comprise the insurgency that the Sudanese government is trying to quelch.
Okay.
Yeah.
At another time during the movie, not this clip, I can't say whether or not it is the Sudanese, I can't say whether it was Mohammed, but there's a claim made by someone in the Sudanese government, look, these are all Muslims. You know, we're sort of fighting insubordinates in our own country. It has nothing to do with ethnic background. These are people that are, like, causing problems, and we're sort of putting it down. At the same time, you know, there's another point in the movie where a man is being interviewed. I don't know if he's Hur or what tribe he is. But needless to say, he is an African Muslim, and he's saying, look, we're all African Muslims, they're all Arab Muslims, and we're the ones that are being killed. And he sort of points out, like, look, I'm not fighting, I'm not doing anything. I was living in my village 2 weeks ago, and now I'm displaced in a humanitarian camp. I don't have any food, don't have any water. I mean, all it has to do with is the color of my skin, my ethnic background. Given that statement, you know, if that's true, it seems to be at the very least a de facto genocide, like perhaps that he's not being killed specifically because he's African, but it is Africans that are being killed, and Arabs are doing the killing. Hope, what do you think?
Well, it's not all, again, I don't claim to know the demographic details of the Sudanese region, but it's, again, narrowed to these ethnic tribes, and I think the Fur is like the main... the predominant one there.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I'll go back to the question that I sidelined before about the legal definition of genocide, because I think it's really important. And this is Article 6 of the Rome Statute, and this is the legal document that governs the International Criminal Court, and hopefully later on we'll get to the fact that the International Criminal Court does have arrest warrants out for various members of the Sudanese government, including the president, on whom we will focus. But in any case, the legal definition, this is Article 6, anybody can look this up on the Internet. It is any of the following acts committed with intent, dramatic pause again, for a reason, because that word intent is extremely important legally, any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. And when I think of genocide normally, before I read this definition, I too thought of the Holocaust, and I thought of, you know, rounding up people and putting them into gas chambers and that sort of thing. In fact, that's just one type of way to commit genocide. I'm going to just read the five types. Number one, killing members of the group. That means, again, a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. So killing, that's one way to commit genocide. It's not the only way. Number two, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. So just, you know, maiming people physically or mentally as members of a group, that counts as genocide. 3, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life. And this goes back to the Ocampo quote, Sarah, that you were quoting, poisoning the well type of thing. But this is actually one of the means of committing genocide. Deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. 4, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. And 5, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. And I think what's really important from this definition is that you do not have to kill to commit genocide. And that's something new to me.
All right, to recapitulate, this is Article 6 of the Rome Statute that we're reading here. But to sort of play both sides, Sarah, you mentioned genocide brings to mind the Holocaust for you and all these terrible things. And of course, as American students, we all learned about the genocide in Germany, Nazi Germany. As students, I mean, it was drilled into our head that, like, this is worst-case scenario for what can happen with government gone awry. And here we have the Sudanese ambassador to the UN, Mohammed, saying, look, this isn't genocide, it's a civil war. Given that, let's just sort of concede the point for the moment and say that no one is trying to systematically or orchestrate a death by genetics of any particular group. I mean, in my mind, genocide does sound a lot more horrendous than civil war. I mean, what do you guys think? As a student, I'd say I'm probably not nearly as inclined to pass out flyers or get up in arms over a civil war than I am a genocide. Do you think this is an over-dramatized political move on the part of U.S. and other countries?
I think that's a really good question.
I would hope not.
I don't know. I think, can you have both? Can it both be a civil war and a genocide?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would say, yeah.
No doubt.
I also want to say, before the show we were talking about, and maybe I should play the other clip. You heard the ambassador of the Sudan saying the United States is the only one who's labeled this as a genocide. It's not entirely true, and I think I should play the other clip now and then come back to this question that Mike asked. So I'm going to play this next clip, and just to set it up, this is also from Darfur Now, and you will hear the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Luis Moreno Ocampo, talking. In part one of the clip, he's addressing the UN. In part two, he's at a radio station giving an interview. And it's really, I think, a clip that humanizes him and his task. So it's about 2 minutes long.
As my office moves toward the presentation of evidence, it sends a signal to those who are considering committing further crimes that they cannot do so with impunity. Thank you very much, Mr. President.
Of course, it is needless for me to re-emphasize again that the referral by the Security Council of this issue to the ICC has been very much politically motivated. The judiciary in Sudan is very well known for its integrity and competence, and we think that it is within the competence of our system that we will prosecute whoever is committing crimes in Darfur.
How many names are you going to present in your submissions?
No, I cannot give the names to you or to Sudan or to the Security Council. So the names and the evidence we present to the judges in February.
There's no way the Sudanese government is going to turn over these individuals for prosecution.
Will you offer the Khartoum a list of the people that you suspect to them?
Perhaps it's time to ignore Sudanese sovereignty.
No. The media usually distorts a lot of things. So if you say this, then they will interpret it differently. So you have to be very careful.
Compared with any complex national investigation, I will tell you this is very fast. We did it in less than a year and a half. So I don't know what are the standards you're comparing to me, because really it was a very fast investigation in a very impossible circumstances. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. I don't know where it's coming from, but it's the four journalists who tell me about why you are so slow. And where it's coming from, the idea we are slow.
For people who are covering this story, I think there's an emotional impatience. You know, people would like the people in Darfur to have an end to their suffering, and they've been waiting and watching. You know, it's like genocide in slow motion.
Yeah. We cannot satisfy people. We have to learn this. We never will be fast enough. Never. Because what happens is a catastrophe. And then you pretend to do justice, and you are used to have a good justice system. You hope something different, but this is just so complicated and so big.
Check your BlackBerry.
So a lot of different things happening in this clip. First, with relevance to our conversation, basically the ICC and presumably all the countries that are members of the ICC are indicting or charging the president of Sudan with genocide. And it seems directly contrary to Mahad's claim, which, you know, was made prior to this charge, that no one is calling this a genocide except the U.S. government, and it's purely a political move. Mm-hmm. Well, here the ICC is sort of coming out and saying, well, we're interested in seeing what happened here. Now, it's important to note that pretending that the president of Sudan does go to trial, which, I mean, there's really no predicting what will happen. As one man commented, Sudan's not going to give up the president. I mean, unless someone goes and takes him by force, chances are he probably won't ever reach court. But even assuming he does, I mean, there's no guarantee that he'll be convicted of genocide. It may be that he's found innocent. But at least the international community is saying, look, there's something going on here that looks like genocide, and we're not happy about it. Mm-hmm. So in regards to our conversation, we're not the only ones. It's not just the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to connect that clip with your question about the Civil War. Like, a civil war seems, you know, at least as bad as a genocide. Is that what you were saying before?
Well,
they don't seem to be motivated as much to hand out cards, that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, the body count has nothing to do with whether it's deemed one or the other, right? So a civil war could cause many more human lives than a genocide. But I know that in my own mind, I mean, the civil war seems like a more neutral, more, I don't want to say harmless, but it seems certainly less demonic and less evil than a genocide.
I was just wondering, like, is it technically, the way that they're saying that it's a civil war, is it technically a civil war if these people are just fighting to stay alive?
Right.
You know? I mean, you can't just, you know, beat a dog and expect it not to try and bite your hand. You know, it's just, you know, these quote-unquote superior people preying on these quote-unquote inferior people or weaker people, you know, just to, you know, for... To what end, again?
And you make an excellent point. You know, even if it was a war among soldiers at one time, clearly it's not now. People who are dying are not soldiers.
Exactly.
And I think that is an important distinction to be made with the Civil War.
It's extremely important, and I want to, you know, connect all of this to the other part of the clip where Moreno Ocampo says, why are people saying that we've taken so long and why this investigation is taking so long? And just in terms of, like, the timeline here, in terms of, like, the legal response on the part of the international community to what's happening in Darfur, again, as Mike said, yeah, the comment by the Sudanese ambassador is somewhat misleading because the international community, through a UN Security Council resolution, number 1593, if you want to look it up, agreed to basically say, ICC, take the case. So the UN Security Council, which is made of 15 different members from all over the world, five of whom are not members of the ICC, and those would be China, France, U.S., Lebanon, and Turkey. Those are the members today. I don't know who the members were in 2005 when this was actually referred to the ICC. But in any case, 2005, the Security Council, the majority of members, of whom are members of the ICC, refer the case to the ICC. That's in 2005. In 2008, this is after the ICC has been doing investigations, and they have not done investigations in Darfur. They really can't get in there. The safety conditions are just too precarious. officially in the displacement camps in Chad where they're doing it. But whatever, 3 years later, 2008, they apply for an arrest warrant. Then in March of 2009, an arrest warrant is given, and I'm just focused on the president, by the way. There's other warrants out. But the arrest warrant is given for the president in March 2009. And importantly, the first arrest warrant addressed not genocide, but war crimes and crimes against humanity. So it could be the case that, you know, I mean, one example of war crimes is targeting non-combatants or targeting civilians. That is a war crime, and that's an international crime. And al-Bashir was initially indicted, or an arrest warrant was given for that, as well as crimes against humanity, includes things like rape and torture and so forth. It wasn't until July 2010, that's just a few months ago, where the ICC agreed to actually issue a second arrest warrant for genocide. So these crimes and what we're talking about, what happens in civil war, going after non-combatants, it's all crimes, but it's only genocide when there's this intent to wipe out a group. And so the evidence for that formally was agreed to rise to the level of, okay, this rises to the level of an arrest warrant just a few months ago for genocide. I just think that's an important point. It's not that, so when we're talking about the bad things that are happening over there, it could be, yes, there's like crimes, war crimes, because non-civilians are being targeted and raped and so forth. But genocide, again, is this intent to wipe out an ethnic group as such.
Right. So I don't know if this is the most important question, but a question that Nick has brought to my attention. So why are we so hung up on this genocide thing? You know, we already mentioned, does body count really matter? I mean, one can be more horrible than the other, independent of what title we choose to arbitrarily give it. So what's really going on here? I mean, either way, people are dying, bad things are happening, and the international community is arguably not doing as much about it as they could. So why are we so hung up on this term genocide?
I guess in my opinion, and I think Hope kind of briefly mentioned this too as we were talking about it before the show, but it serves a particular purpose for motivating the international community if all of a sudden there's a court that's agreeing, like, yes, genocide's going on here, or at least we want to investigate it further to the point, or it's made somewhat apparent, I guess, that this is going on. The international community kind of rallies behind it, which I think brings up another interesting point about what the ICC, kind of what its role is in the international community. So you got these arrest warrants that essentially are just their warrants. It's not like they have a military backing them that they're going to just go into Sudan and take whatever arrest warrants they have and, you know, apply them and bring them back to The Hague. That's not the way that it works. So, like, what purpose is the International Criminal Court serving? In my opinion, and I hope to hear your guys' opinions as well, is that it's serving to kind of show that there is a justice system out there that's keeping watch on it and trying to inform the international community of what's going on and to hopefully bring these people to justice by the involvement of the international community.
Right. I'll go ahead and take a stab at that. I can't speak for the ICC. You know, certainly I'm not a spokesperson by any means, just an interested civilian. But I think they'd like to be, at some time, a real international criminal court. You know, I think they'd like to be a court of tribunal justice when a country can't see justice done for itself. And that being said, you know, we've covered this material on the show before, but I think it's relevant and worth mentioning again. The ICC as a body generally does let a country make their own move. It's only in the case of a referral from the UN or clear violations of humanitarian rights when, you know, countries are just not doing anything to end civil strife that the ICC becomes interested. They'll sort of defer to the nation's own justice system. Just something to add to that, Hope?
Well, the prosecutor does have the power to initiate his own investigation.
Mm.
So there's three ways.
Fair enough.
And another thing I guess I wanted to mention about this, like you said, like the International Criminal Court will sometimes, or I don't know exactly the punishment on it. I don't know how much we want to go into what the ICC does. But I mean, I think punishment's a tricky thing you know, do you want to let the, you know, who really decides what that, what's a fair punishment or not? But in any case, I just want to say that it's not like the end-all, be-all solution of what the ICC is doing. And in Darfur now, you kind of get an example of several different kinds of people's ways of combating this injustice, which are all, I think, worthy of note. One of them, you know, trying to encourage some economic sanctions. You know, if this is a thing over resources and oil, then, you know, if all of a sudden, you know, you're in the United States and you're buying oil from a company that is directly funded, you know, getting funded by the revenues or the revenues of that particular oil that you're buying is going to the Sudanese government, you know, to think twice on that and be like, well, I'm not going to buy that anymore, you know, or to even force legislation, or not force legislation, but enact some legislation that deals with that particular
divestment.
Yeah. Particular thing, and that's what the waiter in the film, what was his name, Stephen?
Adam Sterling.
Adam Sterling, apparently. As well as humanitarian efforts, I think, are another thing to combat that injustice, and I think I'll share an important role in dealing with justice on an international level. You guys have any thoughts about something that I missed on what ways there is to combat international injustices?
So kind of what I hear you saying is that even if, you know, the president of Sudan never reaches the ICC trial, at the very least it sort of brings attention to what's going on there. And then there's sort of these other means, multiple levels on which injustices can be combated. Is that sort of your point? Like, look, Adam Sterling, granted, you know, that he can get enough attention, is trying to pass this legislation in California, which I believe passed, right?
It did, yeah.
And it presumably is trying to be passed throughout the U.S., to sort of economically divest from Sudan, as Nick mentioned, and not support the genocide, not support the injustice going on there. Perfectly valid point. You know, there are multiple levels to combat this. Did you have something to add, Sarah?
Not particularly.
No.
I just want to go back to the original question. I think, like, this list of, you know, and I don't think the ICC has ever claimed to be, like, the sole solution to these huge
right.
problems, but it's a piece, and,
right.
it definitely draws attention. And, you know, you see the people in the film, Darfur Now, going, there's, like, this guy, Moreno Ocampo, and he's going to come and get you and bring you to The Hague. But the other thing I wanted to say is, you know, the situation in Darfur with the ICC is precarious because, the UN, as far as I understand, and I could be wrong, and if so, please call in and correct me, 646-727-3928. But the UN had, like, a peacekeeping force in Darfur, and the same thing happened with Rwanda. And people complained that, you know, it's not enough. And so it was insofar, and the ICC is a completely different entity than the UN. That is, there are members of the UN who are not members of the ICC, completely different court, but the UN can refer cases to it. And, you know, one wonders the motivation in doing this and not, like, why doesn't the UN, knowing that the ICC doesn't have a police force and knowing that the UN can mobilize peacekeeping missions of, you know, relative magnitude, why not do that? So one could say, well, this actually referral on this huge issue is perhaps, you know, even harming the legitimacy of the ICC because it's so hard for it to operate alone. And I know the U.S., who's not a member of the ICC, when this was referred, passed another resolution that said, hey, you know, let's make sure that none of the non-member states are paying for this at all. And that was passed. Yeah. Sorry.
It's okay. So, to go from here, we've got this atrocity. We've got interested members of society trying to deal with it, Adam Sterling,
George Clooney,
Don Cheadle. Now the International Criminal Court.
Yeah, and I also want to say, going back to the UN complexity, I'm pretty sure that the African Union, which is, you know, like this coalition in the United Nations, are, like, totally against the arrest warrants.
Right.
So that just adds another layer of complexity. So, I mean, as if this goes back to Nick's point, I think, you know, is Africa, the African Union saying, okay, we'll agree maybe there's some bad stuff going on here, but we disagree that, like, a way to actually stop the horrible things is to issue these arrest warrants, and maybe we should go to these other means that you're talking about. But there doesn't really seem to be any movement in that direction. So, yeah, but I think this is why people are so upset, because nobody really seems to be doing anything, and they're giving it to the ICC is not all that. At one point in Darfur now, they're showing the courtroom one of the ICC, and Moreno Ocampo is saying, look, this is like where the witness, the audience sits. And he says, you know, imagine that, you know, we have the president of Darfur here, and you have, like, the Darfurese people sitting and watching him being indicted. And I just also, that struck out to me because they need to, like, get on a plane and get to The Hague, and it's, you know, expensive. And it's, when I was there, there was, you know, nobody except white people and classes and journalists and so forth watching the trial involving child soldiers. So
you're saying it seems very impractical for that would ever be the case. That,
yeah,
you know, that some atrocity would go on, the perpetrator of it would be on the stand being indicted, and
mm-hmm.
the people that were the victims of it would be actually in the audience watching this, almost as, like, this kind of symbol that, you know, this, like,
it should go on. Yeah, no, I think it should go on, and I think it does go on in other ways that we've handled these conflicts, like the Rwandan tribunals, those happen in, I believe, Tanzania. So when the actual justice is done on the ground in the place where the harm is done, that may be, like, a more effective, but I still think there's, like, this message, you know, you have this body, the International Criminal Court, it's like, it has this sort of authoritative air to it when an arrest warrant comes out from this body. But practically speaking, you know, the way that the court works and the fact that the victims are not there and the trial is not done on the ground where the atrocities are committed, right, maybe it's not the most effective means of achieving justice.
But is it without, is it outside of the possibility of the ICC to be able to move particular justice, the physical court?
I don't think so. I think it's such a young court. You know, I think it's probably open to doing things like that. Right now it's so new. It hasn't even gone through its first case that it's business as usual, you know, in The Hague. So I don't see why it couldn't do that. The Isabella County Trial Court comes onto the campus of CMU sometimes and has its court right here. So why not?
It's not really, you can simply hop on a bus and show up at the Sudan, though. I mean, right, there's some logistical problems, a little more complicated.
Well, they have investigators on the ground there, so there's got to be people doing, like, gathering the evidence. So there's definitely, like, personnel from the court
right.
already there.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, yeah, sorry.
So I guess I want to try to just reiterate the complexities, or at least try to go through the complexities in my mind of what I see going on with the situation in Darfur, a little more extended than I think what we've been doing. So my understanding is that there's also these little, like, sub wars going on between Chad and Sudan, and that
mm-hmm.
these wars, and that it's weird because I don't know, in the article that I keep referring to, it's called Neglecting Darfur. It's on our show resources page, and it's put together by Enough Project. You can visit them at www.enoughproject.org. But the president actually went over to Chad for peace talks, which the ICC has some jurisdiction there in some regard. I don't know if Chad has signed the Rome Statute, but for some reason, when I was reading the article, they definitely state it's, you know, he was at risk of being taken by the ICC there. In any case, he goes over there for these peace talks, they end up just being this kind of showboat thing, and then they're kind of back at war, and it seems to be like there's this advantageous thing for them to be at war with each other on occasion, which seems absurd. You know, why would anyone want to be at war with each other? But it seems to be, again, over resources and to be able to kind of push out a particular group or certain people to advance the resources. Now, me saying this, again, I want to just, like, say it's super complex, and I'm just scratching the surface of it, so, you know, definitely read through the article yourself. There's much information in it. I just wanted to kind of add another layer of complexity that's there. Also, another thing that was suggested about in the article was that the Janjaweed, which are the kind of, as Hope made an analogical reference to, Blackwater, which is this independent force or this independent militia of the government seeking out and trying to supposedly get rid of the people that had attacked the government installments, that they are actually, once they were armed and they've grown, I guess, out of the control of the Sudanese government. So now it's too hard for the Sudanese government to dismantle the, I guess, the independent militia that they started. So that's one of the other arguments that's kind of on the side of the Sudanese government, is now that they have this group that's kind of gotten out of their control. But again, what comes back into play, and that seems to override this, is then why is the Sudanese government, you know, dealing with the humanitarian efforts in the way that they are? So I don't know. It just seems like a very, very complex issue.
But on the other hand, there was that convoy who did make it through in Darfur now. Do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
So it could be, you know, I don't know, but it could be like these attacks on convoys are rare. They could be the norm, but, you know, you do see, like, I forget the guy's name, Pablo something.
Pablo Ricaldi.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, Pablo says, you know, they were shooting at our NGO or something not too long ago, and nobody was killed, and it's a miracle. And then they show his whole convoy going out, and they come back successfully. So there are moments of success. So maybe it's just like these rogue people. I think that there's this analogy here with the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, because it could be like the main people in charge of the warring factions want peace, but you have like these rogue elements who are like, you know, don't sell out, and they're the ones fomenting the violence. So that's why it's an extremely complex issue. I just, you know, don't have the authority to say anything about the efficacy. I'm pretty sure that the Sudanese have kicked out or no longer allow humanitarian aid. I mean, Darfur now is 2007, so I don't know what the status is now. Again, if you want to, you know, enlighten us, leave a comment on our show page, whatever. We're just learning.
Right. If we haven't said it already, we certainly should have said it by now. The Sudanese government vehemently denies any connection with the Janjaweed, which, you know, there has been some evidence presented at the ICC. It's sort of shown in Darfur now that perhaps they're, well, I think the implication is that they're flat out lying. But there's an argument there, needless to say, and it's not entirely clear. But as Nick has pointed out, you know, it's perfectly possible this group has become autonomous in the nomenclature of the sort of Muslim Israel interaction. We'd call them extremists. You know, this group that, as Hope pointed out, is diehard, won't give in, is holdout. So needless to say, it's a very complex issue. People are certainly dying.
Yeah, and another complex issue, I guess, is brought up again in the article, just to kind of keep the complexity levels on the high.
I have something to add to it as well after you're done.
Okay, yeah, and I think, you know, we can probably keep going with this for quite a few shows, and we just may. But in any case, one of the things is that you have these displaced people that are moved away from their homes, and one of the problems is they don't have anywhere to go, so you have these refugee camps. But then the Sudanese government's trying to, I guess, move them back to their particular original spots, but then they go back to the original spots, and there's other people that are there, these people are armed, and so then there's these conflict with these hostile tribes amongst trying to determine whose land's whose based on, you know, they got relocated because of the violence that was being perpetrated against them, then being able to come back to their homeland, find that it's taken by another tribe who's now you know, hostile towards them. It's almost like they don't have a place to go, which I guess it is the case that they don't have a place to go. So I just wanted to say that there's this displacement issue of where do people go now, and people having no place to go.
Yeah, and to add to the level of complexity of this, and this is also from the book Building the International Criminal Court by Benjamin Schiff, published by Cambridge. So the ICC has a number of arrest warrants out. When I was there, I was watching trials of people from Congo, but actually there's also bad stuff happening in Uganda. And if you're familiar with the work of Invisible Children, actually they're coming here in November, but check out their website because they just focus on the child soldier situation in Uganda and have built a really elegant operation dealing with that and other deficiencies in Uganda. But in any case, Sudan actually at one point, this book was published I think in 2008, so it's a couple years old, but at one time when the ICC issued its arrest warrant for some of these rebel leaders, Joseph Kony in particular, in Uganda, Sudan agreed to help them out. And Sudan said, yeah, you guys are after Joseph Kony. We'll help you get him. If he comes into Chad or near us, we're going to help you out. And so here you have the Sudanese government, maybe in anticipation of a pending arrest warrant, just for political reasons, but whatever. This is just a level of complexity. One could argue that the ICC does need the help of the African Union in getting these people. And here you have a case where the Sudanese are offering to help in getting Joseph Kony. If you're interested, towards the later chapter or pages 198, they're from in the book. But I just wanted to say that there's also that political complexity involved. And can the ICC operate without the help of the African Union, really? With 2 minutes left.
My easy answer is no. You know, there has to be some cooperation, as we've discussed a little bit today and on the show previously, but, I mean, it's not as though the ICC has a standing army. Unless there's some sort of nation, either the nation itself or a conglomeration of nations surrounding it that's willing to, you know, sort of go in and see justice done, it's basically just a paper trial until then.
Yeah, I think that one of the ways that one of the defendants from the Congo was caught is that he went to Belgium. So.
And they snagged him?
Yeah. Sarah, did you want to say something?
No.
We have like 2 minutes left, and I think we should alert the listeners to something that's happening. Anybody want to?
Yeah, in New York, September 24th, there's a United Nations, conference or meeting dealing with the situations in Darfur. So if you're interested in that, definitely look into it. I'm not sure exactly on the details of getting into the meeting or anything like that, but it may be something you want to keep your eye on and see what kind of things come out of that particular meeting. This has been Ethics Talks, and good night.
Yeah, and I also want to say that it's possible that around that meeting, our show next week may have some people that are involved in organizing some things around that meeting on September 24th, so, you know, check back next week if you're interested in further discussing Darfur.
Absolutely. We hope we've shed some light. We probably haven't, because clearly it's a complex, cloudy issue. At the very least, I think we've dealt with the reason why Darfur now sort of stays away from the beginnings of this tragic situation. But thank you for joining us. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week.
Night.